Moody's downgrade. What is the latest on the U.S. debt picture? And what about gold?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, there's a lot going on. One kind of piece of information that's been floating around that got a lot of news, especially in the general news, was Moody's downgrade of the U.S. debt situation. But of course, it's the third major one to downgrade the U.S., far behind the other two. One, I think the first one was back in, what, 2011, 2013,
yes, somewhere 2011, there. Right.
The second one was a couple years ago, and
Fitch
now Moody's
was second.
Now Moody's like, yeah, okay, we'll do it the rest too.
Yeah, S&P was 2011, and Fitch was, I think, 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
So what we've seen, I've not seen any different news that has come out about the debt picture as to why they did this.
No.
They were just late to the game.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth looking back over what's going on with the U.S. debt.
It really is, and it's a good topic for today's show. And you know, pretty well universally, everybody that's in the know about how these rating agencies work just kind of went, they just kind of rolled their eyes on, oh, well, Moody's finally got the picture. You know, well, you know, it's only been, we've been talking about this since 2011 with Standard & Poor's. So they did downgrade the U.S., but how significant is that? And I think the last time this happened when we were when Fitch did it, which I think was 2 years ago, I kind of said at that time, well, this is really in the long run, it's a big deal. In the short run, it's a speed bump. And at this point, I wouldn't even categorize this one as a speed bump. Everybody recognizes that Moody's is way too late. And there was no new information whatsoever that came out. They just decided, oh, we'll finally react to what everybody else has already reacted to starting, 13 years ago in the case of Standard & Poor's. That's just insane. But anyway, they have a little bit of a reputation for always being late to the party. So really, I wouldn't even categorize this as a speed bump. Maybe more of a small pothole, but not even that. This hasn't changed anything. It hasn't changed the numbers, hadn't changed their trajectory, hasn't gotten really hardly anybody's attention. I don't think. The bottom line, though, is it does point to a long-term problem. I've categorized the national debt and the growth of the national debt in the past as kind of a cancer growing inside the patient. So again, what would you do if you knew somebody, you know, on the outside, they appear to be healthy, robust, as far as we can tell, but you found out later through an MRI or whatever that there was a tumor in their lung or wherever. Well, you got a cancer tumor there. Well, what are you going to do? Well, it's okay. We'll just let it go. Come by, you know, alcohol, everything's fine. All things are happy. Now you're going to try to kill the tumor one way or another. Now I'm really more impressed with what my wife's been doing with her cancer battle, which is called ablation, which is not necessarily FDA approved in all parts of the body. It's only certain parts of the body in the U.S., and I'm not going to go any further there. That's one reason that many of you already know this. We went offshore for the treatment that we did with her last round of cancer. But the bottom line is, it's extremely effective. You use ablation, you kill the tumor, then the body, the immune system wakes up, says, oh, this is not a good guy, it's a bad guy, and the immune system destroys the tumor. That should really be, in my view, the way cancer is treated, you know, in the future. But anyway, that's a sidebar. But the bottom line is, what I've always made this out to be, what I believe this is the national debt is compounding at a rate that is unsustainable. Currently, the federal debt, now we're going to talk about a little bit, we probably won't do much on this today, but maybe we'll follow this up with next week. You mentioned the deal, Bessette brought up the fact that we might want to set up a sovereign wealth fund. Well, America does own an enormous amount of land. You know, if you go west of Texas, I mean, 2/3 of the land that's out there between, But from New Mexico to California, now California is probably not a whole lot of California owned by the federal government, but almost all the Rocky Mountains have enormous amounts of land owned by the federal government. And so that's an asset. And Bessette pointed out, what about all these other assets we have? And I would say that's valid from the standpoint of, if you want to look at it as, I think you mentioned it when we were prepping for the show, an income statement versus a balance sheet. So an income statement, you're going to be looking at, okay, how much are we getting in current revenue? How much are we paying out in current expenses? That's what you need to be focusing on. And right now, that's where the government is, and what we want to do a lot on today's show. By the same token, if you have a balance sheet that shows how many, what are the value of your assets? Now, I would make the case you can't go out there and sell Western United States to China to raise gazillions of dollars to pay the national debt down. But it still is an asset, and it still could come in handy. And that's the creation of a sovereign wealth fund, to me, is an innovation that really, why hasn't anybody in the United States done this before? I mean, other countries around the world have sovereign wealth funds. Why don't we have one? Well, duh, because we have a stagnant political system. And that's as far as I'm going to take that.
Well, I would, if you're interested in learning more about all those assets, there's a really good interview with Doug Bergman, the Secretary of the Interior, that I listened to earlier this week. It's on the All In podcast. It's from a few episodes ago, so scroll down a little bit on their list of episodes, but you'll see Secretary of the Interior Doug Bergman on the All In podcast. He goes into a lot more detail of what those assets are and what they're considering, how they're going about trying to get an actual inventory of what's possibly out there, because nobody's ever done that. So it's very interesting.
That's amazing. No one's ever done an inventory of the federal government of the assets. That's good grief. I'm rolling my eyes. At least I'm thinking about rolling my eyes. So looking at the deal. So we got to look right today. We're going to focus on the income statement part of it, not necessarily the long-term balance sheet part. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Both are very interesting because if you don't change the income statement, companies can go bankrupt with a whole lot of assets on their books because they can't pay their current debtors. And so that's one of the issues you've got to realize. Hey, this is not, patty cake, baker's man kind of tiddlywinks type of talk. This is something that is a very valid threat to the U.S. government and to Americans over the long run, especially about, I would say, over the next 10 years. Probably not while Trump's in office, frankly. Probably not the next 4 years, unless he tries to become FDR and goes for a third term, But the issue is we need to understand how big is the tumor that's, basically growing. And it's, on the one hand, you can see there's not a whole lot of symptoms right now. In other words, you're not getting a lot of negative symptoms. Now, again, my wife's had multiple rounds of cancer. She had, back in the 1990s, she had breast cancer twice, throat, cervical, uterine, lung, bone. It's a long story. I'm not going to tell it all on radio. But the bottom line is I'm fairly familiar with the cancer battle. But this is what this is like to me. So the deficit, again, is about 7-8% of GDP right now. Now, that historically is very high. We never had one over 4 or 5%, except in recessions. And recessions didn't even get to 7 or 8 until COVID. Now, COVID, it went over 10. But that was a very unusual period of time, obviously. So at this point in time, 17% of the economy of GDP is going to pay taxes. 23% is for spending. So you can see right there, that's not going to work long term. You can't balance that budget that way. The risk of default. What is the risk of default? There are a lot of people out there, and we are going to talk about gold on today's show. We're very positive about gold in the long run, but we're not a gold doom and gloomer type people like some people you hear in certain places on the media. The risk of default by the federal government, to me, is pretty close to zero. What do I mean by that? I mean, let's say the deficit, which is $36 trillion and counting now, goes to $100 trillion in 10 years, which is theoretically possible. You're still not going to have a default of federal debt. It's almost virtually impossible. It's about a 0% chance of default. Now, here's what happens, though, and this is what has happened historically to countries around the world when they get into push comes to shove on an insolvency issue. If push comes to shove, the Federal Reserve in America is the buyer of last resorts of U.S. Treasuries. What does that mean? The Federal Reserve was created. Part of its creation was to provide liquidity to the system in the event of a crisis. So if a default comes near, if we get to the point where, hey, we, you know, our deficit, our theoretically, let's just imagine what could happen in 5 to 10 years. You could get there. What happens if 25% of the federal government budget is now required to pay the interest only on the federal debt? Now, if you think that sounds very high, it is very high compared to today, but it's not inconceivable it could get there if you look at the projections. If you listen to the Congressional Budget Office, they'll tell you that's not going to happen, but I'm just a little bit skeptical about their numbers, not because they're crooked or anything like that or incompetent. The issue is they make certain assumptions. There's the way the Congressional Budget Office does it. They make assumptions, and this is in the law. This is in their bylaws, using current assumptions of where we are today, assuming A, no recessions, B, no major wars, nothing really out of the ordinary, just projecting straight line extrapolation. Straight line extrapolation never works. The last time I still remember, around in the late 1990s, they were projecting that the national debt would be zero before the year 2010. Does anybody besides me remember that? This is when we had a temporary balance of budget, when Clinton was in office. He was cutting government some with basically they were cutting back on certain parts of government, and we had a temporary balance budget. Newt Gingrich likes to take credit for that, and I appreciate him. But at the same time, the vast majority, the Wall Street Journal did an article on it several years, a year or two later. It said the vast majority of how we balanced the budget in 1998 and 9 was we had dot-com billionaires like Mark Cuban selling their dot-com stocks, becoming billionaires overnight, and paying capital gains tax. The capital gains tax is what put us back to a balanced budget. It wasn't because we were raising more in taxes other than that, and it wasn't because we had cut the spending, because we hadn't. The spending just kept marching on and on and on. So anyway, don't let me get too much on my soapbox here, but if push comes to shove down the road, you can see the potential for a perfect storm lining up here. Perfect storm, what happens if we, and most of you know, there's a book called The Fourth Turning that I recommend people read. We had a potential client coming in last week. He said, I've read The Fourth Turning, just like you recommended. I'm like, okay, it's really important to understand that, because it's likely to be what we go through as a country to get to the next stage of what America is going to look like on the other side of this whole thing. And it very, very likely, in my opinion, or very possible, I think it's likely, not possible, that we end up in a major war. Even Trump's mentioned possibility World War III, and I would think it would involve Iran. I don't think they're going to disarm. They're going to placate us enough to get us off their back, probably, but I don't think we're putting them away as a real threat. North Korea is a small country, but get nukes, and then Russia and China together. I think those are the evil axis in this cycle. It could be World War III. Maybe it won't be. So if we want to be optimistic, hey, but don't stick your head in the sand. That's the point. We need to examine. Proverbs, it says, the first to present his case seems right until another comes forward to examine him. The issue is we have to look at all risks. If you don't look at all risks, and I don't mean extravagant, stupid risks that are gazillion to one odd they're going to happen. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about realistic risk. The potential for World War III before 2035 It's not just theoretical. I think it's a realistic risk, if you want to call it that. So what happens when you get to the point where the baby boomers, the 76 million baby boomers, all of a sudden are putting heavy push on the system? Right now, the bulk of the baby boomers are not that old yet. And so I'm a baby boomer right in the middle of that. I'm 69 years old. I just started Social Security this year. Could have waited until next year. I said, let's go ahead and start it now. I'll live a little longer. Hopefully, I'll get a little more payment that way. But Medicare is a part of that. And all of the people that have studied the demographic issues with entitlements, they say, you know, really, Social Security, because the Social Security Trust Fund is a phantom entity, essentially. There's only a bookkeeping entry from the federal government saying, I owe you this money, kind of thing. They all say that the real issue is not Medicare. It's not Social Security. It's Medicare. Medicare is the 800-pound gorilla of the entitlements. But the baby boomers as a whole are not old enough yet. They're not old enough yet for that to be a big problem. So the issue is, vast majority, Ken Dockwald in his book Age Wave said that more than two-thirds of all Medicare spending occurs in the last 9 months of a fatal illness. So as the boomers get another few years down the road, maybe a decade down the road, what you're going to have is enormous demand on the Medicare. And both Medicare and Social Security Trust Fund at this point are scheduled to go bankrupt in the first part of the next decade. Now, bankrupt is, I'm using that term loosely. They won't go bankrupt. They'll get bailed out. But what does that mean? That means more federal spending for the government. So the point is, I was going to be talking as we talk about, is a default by the federal government likely to happen? Again, the answer to me is pretty well close to zero. But here's what could happen, which is a realistic threat to me. Now, I think this decade, just like Alan Greenspan has said, this decade will be like the 70s, a stagflationary decade. He said that in 2017, the second longest standing Fed chairman in U.S. history. He said the next decade is not going to be like the decade we're in right now, which was deflationary undertow because of all the blow up from 2008 and so forth. He said the next one will be unlike we've had since the 1970s. And he mentioned specifically, he said, bonds are in a bubble. Bonds are going to get creamed in the next decade. That's basically what he said. And so far, he's been right about that. Anyway, the point is, as inflation becomes the problem instead of deflation like it was in the last decade, then you've got problems. So the reason that I don't expect that there's ever going to be a default on federal debt is because, again, what we call debt monetization. What does that mean? That means the Federal Reserve can buy all the treasuries. They could do it today. They could say, okay, we don't have 36 trillion. We have a debt of 36 trillion outstanding, but some of that is we owe money to the Social Security Trust Fund, Medicare, blah, blah, blah. The point is, let's just say all of it was owned to somebody else, outsiders, to foreigners. That $36 trillion, in theory, the Fed could create $36 trillion. And how do they create money? The Fed basically, it's a balance sheet entry. They decide, okay, we need $36 trillion. Put it in the bank. Bam. It's a bookkeeping entry. They create that money out of thin air. They spend it. How do they spend it? They buy the $36 trillion that the federal government has in debt. So in theory, we've zeroed out the balance now. Hey, it's a free lunch. That's what the liberals said several years ago. The liberals said when they're practicing their modern monetary theory, which is not a stupid person, but a really stupid theory. They said, hey, you just spend as much money as you want. Don't worry about the debt, because what happens is if we run out of money and the debt gets too big, then just have the Federal Reserve buy it all. It's a free lunch. I'm like, yeah. And what happens when that occurs? If you look at monetary history around the world, when that occurs, you have what's called hyperinflation. Now, the textbook definition of hyperinflation is 100% a year or more. Now, I'm not saying it's going to get that extreme, but I'm not going to rule it out sometime in the next decade or so, because we're pushing that direction. And you tell me how you're going to get Congress to cut enough spending to get this budget under control. Nobody's attacking the tumor at this point. Now, President Trump's trying to attack it. He's not willing to cut Medicare. He's not willing to cut Social Security or any of that kind of stuff. And that's fine. The bottom line, though, is somebody at some point has got to corral this government overspending, which is hyper-escalating. In other words, right now, the overspending is compounding. It's compounding. It's a 6 or 7% of GDP right now. And what happens if foreign investors move out of treasuries? That would trigger a crisis. I'm not saying that's going to happen now. Right now, there's not a really good alternative to treasuries. Bank of America had put together a government bond index, and the U.S. treasuries are 46% of the index. So there's not another vehicle that people with a lot of money, namely people like China, governments and so forth, there's not enough bond issuance out there to support the whole what's needed. So essentially and I think we did a show on this probably a year ago, or still over 60% of transactions internationally occur to U.S. dollars. So this is not a today problem. This is not I'm expecting to fall off the cliff tomorrow kind of problem. This is a 5 to 10 year out problem, and we'll have to monitor it as we go. Currently, if people wanted to only use AAA assets, well, Germany is the largest in probably in the AAA category. Most of them are people like Denmark and stuff, very small countries compared to the United States. Germany has $3 trillion debt compared to the U.S. at $36 trillion. So in other words, they only have $3 trillion of government bonds that you could buy if you want to park your money somewhere in bonds. So the bottom line, Italy, Japan, UK, France, all are below the United States. So their credit ratings are below the U.S. right now. So the key risk, again, is not that the U.S. government's going to go, oh, we can't pay our bills anymore, we're going to default. That's an erroneous assumption by people that don't really understand the situation. The issue is the long-term risk is the value of the dollar and inflation. Because when push comes to shove, if you study monetary history, as I have, over all the centuries of recorded monetary history, when push comes to shove, the politicians do not have the wherewithal. And you tell me if this is currently a situation we have in our federal government. The politicians never have the wherewithal, the kahunas, if you want to call it that, to cut enough spending, especially if you've got a Democratic-type thinking Congress. And essentially, what they don't do is they don't raise enough in taxes to offset the budget deficit. There's always more demand for giving away money than there is for paying taxes. Well, and so what ends up happening is you end up with a hyperinflation type of scenario.
Yeah, their main focus is not what's best for the U.S. Their main focus for a lot of them, get reelected.
Yep.
And you're not going to get reelected if you cut entitlements.
No. Surprise, surprise. So the U.S. deficit, if you round it off to the trillions of dollars, we have about $5 trillion a year being generated in taxes. We have $7 trillion a year in spending. The deficit about $2 trillion. Now, keep that compounding for another 5 or 10 years and tell me it's sustainable. So the issue is interest on the debt can't be cut. Defense is marginal cuts. There's a few non-discretionary items they could cut. But the bottom line is the big gorilla is the $4 trillion being spent on entitlements. And again, most of the baby boomers are quite young. The entitlements are nowhere near where they're going to be. Is it going to be higher taxes? They might raise taxes some, but I think it ultimately is going to be push coming to shove with inflation. So the bottom line is, I think that we're going to have a big problem with the national debt. I think it's going to be a potential existential crisis coming. We hope that we'll have good hope, and we'll talk a little bit about the possibility of raising a sovereign wealth fund in America in order to offset some of that. And I like that idea. I think it's a great idea. The question is, can we get there fast enough? And the issue is, will the tumor keep growing faster than the ability of the body to fight it? And that's where we are right now. So it's unlikely that politically we can cut spending enough. Even if you look at the most recent poll, 71% of the Democrats favored cutting spending versus raising taxes. 78% of the independents, and surprise, surprise, 85% of the Republicans preferred spending cuts to tax hikes. So it's fairly close to political suicide if you cut too much out of the budget. And so I just really don't see that happening in our present lifetime. Push could come to shove, but the bottom line is there's too much going out and there's too many constituents. I'll close this half of the show with a story. A number of years ago, after my wife's first battle with cancer, but before her stroke, we had an episode. She went up and helped a good friend of ours named Andrea Lafferty up in Congress. And she was a lobbyist, but she was a lobbyist for a large church group. But she had been a Washington insider for 2 decades. As a matter of fact, her father was the chaplain, if I remember right, for the House of Representatives. He was one of the senator House chaplains. Very well known, very well liked. She decided to take on one segment of the federal government, one department, and it was Health and Human Services part of the administration. And so they went through the budget. All this material was on the internet. They went through the budget with a fine-tooth comb, came up with spending like you wouldn't believe. Enormous spending. $750,000 grant to study how do prostitutes spread venereal disease at truck stops. And that's one of the least offensive ones that they saw.
I just like to reiterate, when you say it was on the internet, you're not talking about the internet in general. It was on the department's website.
Correct. The department's website. It was on that website. So anyway, they came up with a long list and they compiled a large notebook full of stuff like that. And my wife went down to Kay Bailey Hutchison. No offense to her. She was the chairman of that department, of that committee. And she said, I'm not leaving until I talk to somebody important about this. And so they tried to placate her for a long time and said, okay, hey, wait, this person can talk to you. This person, no, I'm waiting until I see somebody important. And when I see them, I'll know who they are. And so ultimately, Kay's chief of staff came in And they told her, hey, this lady's been here for 4 or 5 hours waiting until she got to talk to somebody important. She says she's just a citizen, not representing some organization. And he goes, well, I'll take care of it. And they go, well, let us do it for you. That's fine. I'll take her. So he took her back in the conference room and said, let me tell you, ma'am, we're not going to cut your benefits. First thing out of his mouth, we're not going to cut your benefits. She said, she kind of set him up with the way she phrased it at first. She said, oh, okay. So she opened up a notebook which showed 4 Ivy League professors dressed in drag and the grant that they were getting for, I don't know how much money it was, but it was a lot of money back then. And she flipped it open to that one and said, what about these guys? And she said, he nearly turned over. He recoiled so hard, his chair nearly fell over backward. He said, that's not the National Institutes of Health. She said, it's off your website. And he just sat there for a moment. He sat there in stunned silence for a moment. He said, ma'am, he said, I'm sorry. He said, I know. He said, for every call that we get to cut spending, we get 1,000 calls, don't touch my benefits. He said, anyway, he apologized, but he didn't have a solution. So the problem is, that's what happens. If you look at history, and I'm not a doom and gloomer. I do believe that America has a future and a plan. God's got a plan for America in the long term. But we may go through some extremely difficult times in the next 10 years or so. And the issue is that we talked about this from Andrew Tytler Frazier in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond. A democracy only lasts until the people figure out they can vote themselves benefits from the treasury. Then it's destroyed by loose fiscal policy, which ultimately results in hyperinflation and oftentimes in a dictator taking over. And you can look at history, the French Revolution, et cetera. This has happened many, many times throughout history. I'm not voting for that plan of action. I think we're going to have to fight it. But the bottom line is, it's a serious problem. And it's a serious problem we're going to have to tackle. And the first step of any problem being solved is recognition. And right now, I don't think there's enough recognition that this is a true problem. So when we come back from the break, we'll talk a little bit about some solutions. We're going to talk about gold. We haven't talked about gold much at all on our show, but we probably ought to today, as well as just a little bit on the update on the stocks and on the economy.
All right, well, we'd like to take just a short break here to remind you how to learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services. You can find us at cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Learn more about Jerry Tuma, myself, and the rest of our team there. You can get Jerry's latest special report, Bear Market Starting? As we were looking back on the first quarter, it's been a wild ride in the market. A lot of things, just the market cannot seem to figure out what President Trump is doing. But Jerry brings up a lot of the charts that will kind of help us understand what's the backdrop on the economy that's moving on during that same time. So again, you can get that latest special report, Bear Market Starting? You can also listen to previous week's broadcasts and interviews. Just click on the Smart Money tab, Smart Money Radio tab, and you can find those there. And you can also catch us on podcasts on Spotify and Amazon Audible. And for a free consultation, I encourage you, call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 800-327-4285. I know there's a lot of people out there, a lot of discussions about how this U.S. debt is a risk. How could it affect your investments? If you'd like to talk to a group that we bring that into our considerations, we make adjustments into the investments that include things like this because we are concerned about them, but not quite yet, but we still want to take that into consideration. Give us a call at 1-800-327-4285. Well, Jerry, we are going to talk about gold, but before we get there, it'd probably be good to give everybody our update on the economy and the stocks.
And I'm going to try to make this fairly quick because I do want to spend some time on gold. We haven't talked about gold much at all on the show, really probably negligence on my part not doing it because gold's been such a valuable asset over the long term. Starting off with the stock market, the growth stocks are starting to reassert themselves in leadership versus value. And so that's an important component because the value stocks, when they start performing well, oftentimes it's because we're seeing a regression in the economy and stuff. Right now, growth is reasserting itself. Right now, the earnings per share and economic growth favors slowing down. Looks like it'll continue to slow down. That typically, historically, according to Ned Davis, favors the growth stocks. Earnings per share revisions are likely in Q3 and Q4. How much? Don't really know. I don't think anybody really knows because we don't really have a firm handle on how the tariff talks are going to go or tariff wars are going to go. The Magnificent Seven, we've talked about forever, they started outperforming after April 2nd. They underperformed from January till April 2nd. Now they're outperforming again. If you look at Trump's first 100 days and the stock market, well, he fell out of bed. He fell completely off the norm. So there's kind of a channel of here's how well the market does on the upside. Here's the ones on the downside. For the first 100 days in office, he fell out of the survey, literally below the survey. He's popped his way back up to being in the very, very bottom, the bottom 5% of the range. But the bottom line is he's looking at trying to fix a lot of things that have been messed up for a long time in our economy. Gold has room to run. We're going to talk about gold in just a minute. We're in a seasonal period of time, which frequently involves weakness. Sell in May and go away. You may have heard that term before. One of the things I want to drill down on just a little bit is kind of clarify that, and that is that normally when you have issues between May and November, almost all of it happens in between August and November, reality is. So it's kind of a catchy phrase to sell in May and go away, because the long-term studies show that performance, usually the best performance of the year, and this year is an anomaly on that, but the best stock market performance on a calendar basis typically starts November and ends in May. This year,
well, I would also bring up that way. In those cycles, you don't normally have this much volatility in the first quarter. That is not average.
Absolutely
not. So it looks like an unusual year.
All right. So it may not be the same in the second half this year. We'll see. But August to November could be weak. That's usually the case. We know that we're in a relief rally from the tariff talk. On the economy side, everything's kind of, I don't want to say flatline, but we're not going up. We're not going down a lot. It's reduced. All the analysts that we track have reduced, they've cut their GDP projections. I mean, typically from 2.5% to 1.5%, but that's still growth. Joe Kalish with Ned Davis brought out, we're continuing to see one after another small challenges, none of them enough to cause a recession at this point, but he called it layers of risk. First, we have obviously the tariff changes, which could be bigger in terms of if those talks don't go well, now that's a game changer. But if we do get something negotiated, which I think is more likely, that's not a game changer, but it does slow down. So if you ever watch those races, I used to watch the Wide Wide World of Sports almost every weekend with my dad. And, you know, I always remember the drag racers that wait, you know, go down the Christmas tree of lights, you know, red, yellow, green, zoom, and they take off. And then all of a sudden the parachute pops out at the end and starts the slowdown process. The issue is these are all sort of like little mini parachutes that right now are going to have a slowing impact, but not enough to crash everything, if you will. So the tariff changes are one. The Doge cuts, basically that means fewer people are going to be working for the federal government here in a few months. The deportations, fewer people working, the negative wealth effect, which if the market holds up, that'll go away for a while. The decline in tourism has been happening as a result of all these talks. And now we got a student loan situation that's kind of picking up as a little bit more of a problem. You know, credit card delinquencies are high right now, 12.3%. Auto delinquencies are about 5%. But student loans are really going to be a little more than most people are imagining. There's $1.63 trillion of student loans, and it involves 43 million people. The default rate's popped up to 7.7%. We don't know if it's going to go a lot higher. It might. But the bottom line is the savings rate has fallen below half of what it was, the historical average, since the pandemic. And so what's happening is a lot of these debts problems are manifesting. Again, none of them by themselves would cause a recession. All of them together might not cause a recession, but all of them are slowing factors for the U.S. government and for the economy.
All right, Jerry. Well, now that we've updated everybody on our current situation with the economy and stocks, we wanted to save time to talk about gold, because gold in the long run, we're still pretty positive on for many reasons. And so we'd like to get into that.
There's a lot of reasons you should consider, and I think we consider it kind of a core holding to have gold in your portfolio. And the reasons for it are accelerating, not decelerating. And I think they're going to continue to accelerate over time. And one of the things you need to realize is a little bit of buying can make a huge difference. Last year, gold mining gold mining internationally for the entire country or the entire world grew a whopping 2% in new supply of gold coming out. So what's happening is there's a very small amount of gold available in the world. One analyst said, hey, you could take all the gold that's ever been mined in the history of the world and get it into one Olympic swimming pool. Now, Olympic swimming pools are pretty big, but that's, I mean, if you consider the trillions and trillions of dollars of international exchange and so forth, there's a very limited supply of gold that could be out there. And really, the float, meaning what's actually available to be bought, is very tiny compared to the amount of currency that's in the world. So gold went to about $2,000 an ounce. It went from really around $300 during the dot-com craze, 99, 2000, up to about $2,000, just under $2,000 an ounce around 2011 or so. And then it had a stagnating period. It went down, bottomed out around $1,100 around 2016. Now it's up to $3,500. The question is it too high? Is it too high? Is this time to sell high? And the answer, in my opinion, is probably not. If you look at gold's runs, because again, it's exaggerated. Most of you are familiar with the concept of pneumatic pressure. If you go out and you've got a bulldozer, the bulldozer has pneumatic pressure on the buckets. And so what it'll do is you have a little bit of force going through those pneumatic tubes that causes the whole bucket to move. That's pneumatic pressure. And so it's a very small amount of fluid that you're pumping into the system, but it has an outsized move on what it affects. That's kind of what I'm talking about here with only 2% new growth in the mining of gold annually. It's just not enough to cover everything. But this is not the exceptional run yet compared to many times in the past. In the 1970s, the first run started, they legalized gold in 1974. 1971, Richard Nixon closed the gold window. What had been happening was the federal government had pegged the price of gold at $35 an ounce in the Great Depression. So if you start and go back further, here's what was going on. In the crash of the banks were crashing between, remember, 1929 crash started. It ran until 1933, the crash of the stock market did. And during that period of time, there was a continuous problem with bank runs. You remember the Jimmy Stewart, you know, it's a Wonderful Life movie. They had to stop the bank run with his own money. He was going to go on his honeymoon to Europe or wherever. The point is we lost about one third of all banks during that 4-year period. Now, Milton Friedman, who's again, he's the guy that I've kind of discipled under one of his disciples at UT Arlington, Dr. Richard Wilson. Point is, Milton Friedman was an incredible critic of the Fed during that time. He said one of the reasons the Fed was created, the primary reason the Fed was created in the first place, was to create liquidity in the event of a crisis. Here you are sitting there on your hands doing nothing while bank after bank after bank after bank goes under. And obviously it's a chain reaction, like a series of dominoes. So what happens again is you end up, okay, bank A can't pay its bills, it goes bankrupt. Well, unfortunately, that affects bank B. And so it had the same effect with people. They couldn't pay their bills, they couldn't finance their debts. We had a bit of a debt bubble through the 29 stock market mania that you had in 1929. And all of a sudden, dominoes, domino, domino, bank, 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 bank. The only way it finally stopped was FDR got into office. He said, we're going to have a bank holiday for a week. He closed all banks in the United States for a week. And so he declared a bank holiday. But simultaneous to that, part and parcel of that, he said, by the way, we're going to outlaw the ownership of gold. Why? Because people trusted gold more than they trusted the banks at that point, and they were taking their money. Part of what was creating part of the problem was they were taking their money out of the banks and putting it in gold. And gold was legal tender. You have the $20 St. Gaudens gold piece and other numismatic type coins that nowadays are numismatic coins. Back then they were legal tender. So you could say, I've got a $20 bill backed by the federal government, the Federal Reserve, backed by not much, full faith and trust of the U.S. government. Or I've got a gold coin, which has always been wealth, and people were taking the money out of the banks, and part of the run on the bank is part of it was going into gold coins. So Roosevelt said the only way to stop this and stop the bank runs permanently, he outlawed gold. He said, okay, gold, we'll give you $25 for your $20 gold piece. And 95% is the number I've heard regularly referred to. 95% of the people complied. They said, okay, we will sell. Of course, we're in the middle of the Great Depression. The banks are closing left and right. You've lost one third of the banks. The gross domestic product of the country has shrunk by one third, coincidentally, just about amount the same as the banks. About a third of the banks and about a third of the GDP went away. And people were crushed. The stock market had gone down 90%. We remember 2008 was a big crash. This was a crash way beyond the magnitude of that, a 90%, 90% crash in the U.S. stock market. So at that point, people were kind of willing to be compliant. They were like, oh, we've been crushed on every hand. So they sold their gold back to the federal government, the $20 gold coins. They got $25, so they got a 20% premium on their gold. Immediately, once the confiscation, if you want to call it that, once we sold our gold back to the government, then he marked it up. He said, now the new official price of gold is 35 an ounce. So the government coincidentally made a very nice profit on that transaction. Anyway, and I'll kind of ignore any snide remarks that I can make about that. But the bottom line is it traded at 35 an ounce from then on. That was the official pegged price of gold in the United States. And gold ownership, going out to buy U.S. Eagle, Canadian Maple, whatever, was illegal. You couldn't own gold. So the problem is they kept the peg at $35 an ounce. Well, the gold was still the dollar. You could take dollars and convert them into gold if you were a foreign person, so foreign government or whatever. They could go, okay, look, we got all these dollars from all these transactions we've had in the United States. We've been through World War II. We had all this growth. So by the time you got to 1971, now this is what, almost 40 years later, the value of gold is still pegged at 35 an ounce, and gazillions of dollars had been printed in the meantime to pay for the budget deficits and all that, and then the wars, and the Vietnam War, and the Korean War, and all that. And so the Europeans were raiding the treasury, so to speak. They were cashing their government bonds into gold. I said, okay, pay us in gold. We're going to convert $35 of this into gold and buy. And so best estimates are we lost about a third. It's going to be interesting to see if we really do audit Fort Knox. But anyway, reportedly about a third of the gold that the United States owned at the time went out the window, mostly into Western Europe. Giant bags of St. Gaudens and so forth type coins went over there. And so Nixon realized, President Nixon was in office in 1971, this is before Watergate, and he realized this is a crisis. We are getting to the point where they're taking all the gold out of Fort Knox or the New York Federal Reserve, and it's going into Western Europe because of our debts, because we have interest compounding on the national debt, treasury, etc. So he outlawed, number one, he first stopped that. He said, okay, we're going to cut off the peg between the U.S. dollar, or you know, converting gold into anyone else's currency or into dollars. So basically, he outlawed that. He said, okay, we're not going to convert any of our gold anymore. Over and out, period. Then at the next step, as he made the ownership of gold legal. But keep in mind, it had been at $35 an ounce, pegged for almost 40 years. 40 years by the time they undid it. So essentially, at that point, gold had a catch-up factor in the 70s. It was like, okay, housing's gone from whatever the, you know, let's say a house was, you could probably buy a house for $500 in the Great Depression. Well, now it's $20,000 or whatever. So there's a massive catch-up effect in gold, and it went from 35 an ounce up to 800 an ounce by the end of the decade. You had a 300% rise in the early 70s. You had a 500% rise in the late 70s. A lot of that was gold, but a lot of that was because of inflation, because we had incredible hyperinflation in the 1970s. Historically speaking, gold and inflation do well together. When you're having inflation, gold typically does it very, very well. So again, part of that big jump was catch-up factor from gold being artificially oppressed at $35 an ounce versus the consumer price index or whatever you want to peg it to. But part of that was just we had high inflation. If you track the consumer price index and the price of gold in the 70s, they were mirror images, looked like tracing paper, essentially. So that's the story of how gold got freed up until 1985. Then it went through about a 20-year period of consolidation where it was at 300 an ounce, bounced up to 500, 300, 500, 300, 500, until finally we got out of the dot-com craze, and then it began to change again because the dot-com was capturing all the money, gold was getting nothing, but we've since had big rises. During the crash October 2008 to October 2010, you had an 80% rise in gold prices. Now, that's pales compared to the 70s, but that's still a pretty good chunk of change, especially during a time of crisis. Now, if you look at what people buy gold for, jewelry and fabrication is about 33% of gold demand. And I'm sorry, jewelry is about 33% of gold demand. Fabrication, 7. The financial assets, though, is where the big growth is. So as a financial asset, and I still remember the old days when the Keynesians would laugh about gold. And one guy, it's like a pet rock. Gold's antiquated. I mean, we're not cavemen anymore. We don't need gold. We're masters of the universe. We're Keynesians. We know how to deficit spend. We know all this stuff. And so the bottom line is that kind of stuff just made me gag. But the point is real simple. That story is not valid anymore. It has changed radically. So now 60% of the money that's going into gold annually is coming in as a financial asset. Why would that be a financial asset? Well, just think about it here for a second. Number one, if you had a whole bunch of dollars and you're worried about the dollar going down in value or the solvency of the federal government someday, maybe you want to diversify out of treasuries. That's been happening a lot. Matter of fact, when Russia had the G10 froze their FX reserves, their foreign reserves, gold has gone up more than twice since then. You have countries like Poland, Turkey, and India wouldn't even thought about gold years ago that are now buying it in massive amounts. China only has 6.8% of its reserves in gold out of 3.6 trillion in gold. That could be a lot more growth there. So the bottom line in these countries as they're buying them, that's really where most of this is coming in. It's not American citizens buying ETFs. That's a contributory factor in a bull market for gold, but that's not where the real long-term demand is coming from. The long-term demand that's strategic from these different countries is pretty well unaffected by price fluctuation, meaning they're considering this a core allocation to preserve the capital of our country and the central banks. And Asian buying has just surged. It's extremely popular in India. A lot of that's because basically dowries and weddings. So the bottom line is this: gold has served as a store of value for all of history that we know of. You know, some people go back and say, hey, well, back in the caveman days, they used rocks to trade with. I'm like, well, maybe. But I've yet to see anything that gives me any kind of historical accuracy that says it was really rocks. Now, I don't know when the first caveman, probably not a caveman, but I don't know when the first people finally discovered gold, but gold has always been a currency. It's been a store of value forever and a currency, and it's done an extremely good job. If you look at it over the super long run, you know, you could buy a suit of clothing in 1920s and a really nice suit of clothing, it's, you know, right now, it'd be fairly similar to price-wise, but the bottom line is, it serves as a store of value, and it serves at this point, it's becoming a crisis hedge. So I want to say I'm not a gold bug in that I've seen people say, yeah, put 25% of your money in gold. Well, if you want to be really aggressive, then go for it. But the bottom line is it's pretty easy to make the case of at least 5% and sometimes 10%, and I'm not allowed to really get too far into those woods. But the bottom line is I think gold is a strategic ownership asset that most portfolios should have a portion of it in, and I'm not going to go a lot further than that, but just to say, if you look at the things that are really driving where we're headed, we talked in the first half of the show about the long-term trend for the dollar and the deficits and what's going on with Congress and all the overspending and stuff like that, and you just push that forward. Let's assume there's no miracle cure. Let's assume that, you know, and again, we're going to examine the flip side of this on next week's show. So can America create a sovereign wealth fund? Can we solve the problem that way? I'm skeptical, but I want to be open-minded about it, especially with President Trump. I'm trying to support what he does. For the most part, I agree with him on most things. But the bottom line is real simple. You have to look at the history of the world. If you look at the history of the world, when push comes to shove and, quote, democracies, which reality is, I would make the case we're a constitutional republic, not a democracy. The Democrats have pushed the democracy thing for 50 years, telling us we're a democracy. Well, a pure democracy, as you know, one person, one vote, and everybody's votes count equally. In this case, we do have one person, one vote, and hopefully they're registered voters. But the bottom line is we still have a different system. And so you have the way of counting them by state as opposed to massive. Well, if we had more people in Los Angeles and New York than Philadelphia, all voting Democrat, then you're going to win everything you have if it was just a pure democracy. So it's not a pure democracy. I would make the case it's really not. It's really a constitutional republic. But the bottom line, that gets too esoteric here to keep going on that whole topic for the day. And it's not a subject of what we're going to talk about. Or it's not really what we want to talk about on today's show. Plus, we're out of time. But the bottom line is, I think it makes sense to have that as a part of your strategic allocation and as a long-term piece of diversification for your portfolio. We'll talk more about that possibly next week, but Serna will talk a little bit about what happens if President Trump is able to set up a sovereign wealth fund. Does that solve all our problems? We're going to have the tooth fairy come down with her wand and go, ding, all problems solved. I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to look at it, and I'm hopefully this will be an area which I think will help. I think the Doge cuts helped. They didn't solve the problem. They're not going to. But everything we need right now, any help we get right now, is helpful. Jerry Tuma, Michael Williams with Smart Money. We'll talk to you next week.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.